The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Okay, let's go ahead and get started here. Let's look at what the editor-in-chief has to say today. Sweet spot. We would drive half the night to get there, north through the Central Valley, then northeast on 299 to split the gap between two volcanoes, Shasta and Lawson, before entering the Fall River Valley, elevation 3,000 feet, population 1,000, watery and moonlit. The pitch-black last mile by dirt wound eerily through forested lava rock, rabbits and coyotes darting into the headlights. When we got close to the cabin, the kids, Rachel and Neil, would sense it, waking to shout as they spotted it yards from the narrow spring-fed river. At dawn, Neil would rise to the honking geese overhead, and he and I would head out. Imagine a stretch of pristine river in California's empty corner, framed by meadow, a small peak, and bird life that practically roars. Neil was a born birder, and within a minute he'd have identified up to 15 species. By the time we'd stopped back into the porch to show the others our loot, owl pellets, squirrel skulls, hawk feathers, Susan would be making coffee and Rachel deep into a book. The day unwound in chapters, a canoe ride downstream to Carl's haunted cabin, wrecked but ghostly upright, a yelp-inducing dive off the dock into 59-degree water, brr, a trip up the scrub road to a neighbor's ranch. There we'd peer into the dark at the great horned owls living in the barn and climb the stacks of horse feed we called blueberry hay for its color and scent. The memory's triggered by the photo above, and there's a picture of two kids. Above, maybe rose-colored, but they do not lie. 15 years of those journeys to that valley forged our family of four for the long haul. It's not easy to express the power of family, but a single photo can occasionally do the trick. That's what we sought in this year's Reader's Photo Contest, and you came through. And please enjoy the winning submissions. I find deep meaning in the stories they tell. I hope you do, too, and I'll do my best to describe them. And let's look at some letters from on the May issue. How the Internet is spying on you. An internet-connected fish tank? Of course you're going to expose yourself once you install smart thermostats and refrigerators. Sure, there is convenience and time saved, but at what cost? Your security? When was the last time you heard of a piece of paper being hacked? John Skelton, Independence, Missouri. I don't believe I have the most desirable identity to steal, but I believe my thoughts are my own. Whether I have a pimple on my nose or I'm looking up information or I'm ordering pizza or browsing for shoes, others monitoring my usage is a great intrusion. Teresa Nero, Kalamazoo, Michigan. Jewel hooks, a new generation. What a surprise. When I saw that people are becoming addicted to vaping without realizing how dangerous it is, I read your article, Cancer by the Carton, way back in December 1952. I quit smoking the next day. I turned 97 a few days ago, and I'm often reminded about healthy decisions I've made in my life. That was a big one, thanks to Reader's Digest. Marina Dollison, Tracy, California. The story on the perils of smoking and vaping is well taken. It reminds me of an anecdote I read in the Reader's Digest. A girl says to her father, "Daddy, I smoke." He replies, "No, dear. The cigarette smokes. You are merely the sucker." Aaron Sweaterman, Webster, Texas. How to feel happier today? I'm taking Yale University's online course on happiness, so imagine my surprise to see your story about it. Like the author, I'm a grown woman, not a typical college-age student. I'm barely halfway through it, but feel the benefits already. Jane Podersky, Kingston, New York. A crash course in commencement speeches. As someone who worked at a university for 20 years, I find it appalling that a celebrity demand $100,000 to give a 10-minute speech in front of a group that may never be able to pay off student loans. Also, shame on schools for paying those amounts, especially when they raise tuition every year. I agree. Robert Austin, Baltimore, Maryland. We found a fix. The third item in your list of tips has us confused. It says to freeze leftover wine ice cube trays in ice cube trays. What is leftover wine? Is that like extra money? Because my wife and I have never seen either. Lawrence Rivera, Vero Beach, Florida. How true is that? My dad and I rebuilt. This is also my story. My dad taught me to drive a 38 Studebaker stick shift in a cornfield. His pocket knife was the correct knife for apples and cantaloupes, and I still have his handmade tire gauge case from 50 years ago. After his passing, I had a dream where he said he'd give me all the tools he knew. Becky Benskweski, Point St. Lucie, Florida. Straight from the horse's mouth. Your account of the Kentucky Derby from the horse's end is the funniest article I've ever read. Thanks for helping me forget about sitting at home during the pandemic. Eileen Hart, St. Liberty, Illinois. Butter us up. I was horrified by the sentence, "The lima beans of the world, and I am butter." What's wrong with lima beans? We told our kids they were Superman beans, and they loved them. So give lima beans a break. I will continue to eat them with butter, of course. Sandy Howland, Aurora, Nebraska. I've always said everything's better with butter on it. This article brought back memories of Oma baking German pastries with real butter. It made all the difference. CM via ReadersDigest.com. Everyday Heroes. And there's a picture of a couple, a cute blonde lady and a rather tall, somewhat hefty gentleman, and two little girls. One looks like she's probably about four, and the other's probably about seven or eight. And they have a bunch of signs in front of them. You are not alone. Valas mucho. Your mistakes do not define you. Amy and Jake Wolf, along with daughters Harper and Avery, planted the first batch of Don't Give Up signs around Newburgh, Oregon. The shirts off their back. Michael Todd won the same clothes every day for the first 3 weeks of school. When the other kids began to notice that he was wearing the same black pants and blue, teal, and gray long-sleeved shirt day after day, Todd, a freshman at Martin Luther King Jr. College Preparatory High School in Memphis, became the target of taunts and laughter. But there was little Todd could do. His mother simply couldn't afford to buy him new clothes. Two of the kids piling on were Antoine Garrett and Christopher Graham, a pair of freshman football players. But over time, they realized what their disparaging words felt like, bullying, and seemed to be slowly crossing Todd's spirit. Something finally clicked. And there's a picture of the three boys. And interesting enough, two boys are African-American, and Todd, the one with the clothing problem, is white. "I felt like I needed to do something," Graham told CBS News. So he and Garrett hatched a plan. They went home and hunted through their own drawers and closets. The next day in school, they met Todd at their third period class and asked him to come into the hall. Todd was understandably apprehensive about being called out by the larger boys, and they're both football players, so they're big kids. "He wasn't smiling or anything, and I was like, 'I think this is going to make you smile,'" Graham said. "I told him, 'We're in the same third period, and I apologize for laughing at you. And I want to give something to you to make it up.'" He then handed Todd a bulky bag. Inside were clean shirts and shorts, plus a brand new pair of New Balance sneakers. Todd was blown away. "I was very happy," he told WATN-TV, shocked completely. And Todd got much more than a new wardrobe. He no longer sits alone at lunch. Now he eats with his new friends, Garrett and Graham. "I've been bullied my entire life," Todd told CBS News. Reflecting on the day Garrett and Graham called him into the hall, he added, "The best of my entire life, best day of my entire life, basically." Kids can sometimes be so good. I'm sorry, I kind of screwed that up. I missed the part about the sign, so let's try this again. The couple with the two girls, "Don't give up." Her heartbroken hometown needed a sign, so she gave them one. The signs appeared practically overnight. They'd been staked anywhere and everywhere, in front of homes, along sidewalks, around the local high school. Each featured just a few uplifting words in simple black type. "Don't give up. You are worthy of love. Your mistakes do not define you." The high school in Newburgh, Oregon, had lost two students and four alumni to suicide that year, so the town of 25,000 instantly understood the messages. For days, what no one could figure out was who had planted them. Amy Wolf had. At first, she didn't want anyone to connect her to them. For one thing, the 36-year-old mother of two didn't really feel it was her place to weigh in. She had done so, in part, because she'd lost her own teenage brother in an accident about 20 years earlier, and she felt compelled to address Newbrook's grief. She planted the signs anonymously because she wanted them to be about their message, not about any one person. It was compassion for compassion's sake. I couldn't just do nothing, says Wolf. I'm not qualified, but gosh darn it, I can print yard signs. Yet as Wolf saw the deep quarter sign struck with the neighbors, she decided to step forward and share her message publicly. Instantly, her inbox was flooded with requests for more signs. She asked a friend, graphic designer Jessica Brattell, to mock up and print another batch, and then another, and another, and another. We decided just write it out and not push it. Just keep going until the order stops, said Wolf. That ended up being an inside joke because it never stopped. That was in May 2017. Since then, the Don't Give Up movement has spread from Newburgh to the hearts and yards of people in every state and several countries. The signs have morphed into wristbands, bumper stickers, pins, stamps, and temporary tattoos. Wolf charges only the cost of materials and shipping. It's a terrible business decision if we wanted to function like a business, she says. One of the most heartening elements of the Don't Give Up movement is it has gone viral in a remarkably human way. People have taken to playing the signs in their lawns, taking selfies, and then posting them to share. Chris Ann Moger commented one of the movement's Instagram posts about the need for one particular sign. We're all in this together. She thought it would really speak to a world huddling under the cloud of COVID-19. Wolf agreed, and she received 750 orders within a week of its creation. And there's a picture of a dog sitting next to a You Matter sign. A mother in Colorado contacted the organization after her stepson's sudden death to say that her family, unable to travel during the quarantine, couldn't attend the funeral. We weren't able to be together to love, support, and help each other heal, she wrote. I saw one of your signs recently. It was a gut-punch message from above to hang on. Aware of the added emotional challenges isolation brings, the Don't Give Up movement has since offered to send handwritten letters of support to anyone in quarantine who needs it. The group received about 400 requests in just 24 hours. A young woman in New Jersey wrote that she struggles with mental illness and that the shelter-in-place rules were especially hard on her and her family. She asked whether the Don't Give Up group could send her relatives a cheerful note. One special education teacher in Texas used the campaign to teach lessons in Unity after his classroom moved online. Isaiah Brown created care packages stocked with Don't Give Up goodies, including wristbands on which he'd written a student's name alongside his own. He then drove to a student's home to drop the packages on their doorsteps. Some of the kids were so excited to get the surprise delivery that they ran outside to see Brown through his car window. The next time his class gathered online, the students couldn't stop chattering about how happy the gifts had made them. One student gleefully declared that he would never take his wristband off. It was the best feeling in the world that I could have an impact outside of school by using these products, says Brown. This was a good way to let them know that we care, even when we can't see them. Wolf's message is about to grow yet again. After seeing her signs online, a literary agent called to negotiate a book deal. Signs of Hope: How Small Acts of Love Could Change Your World. Will be out next spring, after some last-minute revisions. I wrote that last chapter in the middle of the outbreak, not knowing how long this would go on for, Wolf shares. But there has never been a more drastic backdrop to the power of hope and sympathetic action than right now. Amen. Life in these United States. There's a cartoon, man and woman are sitting in a restaurant and a waiter is standing right there next to him, and this is what he says. You can substitute broccoli for the asparagus, but you can't substitute another glass of wine for the fries. Sorry about that. My 4-year-old just asked why she can't eat tacos every day. And honestly, I think I'd have an easier time explaining where babies come from. I loved the dress that I bought at a flea market. It fit perfectly, and the skirt was a twirl of intricate pleats. I wore it confidently to an evening party and glowed when a woman exclaimed, "Oh, how stunning." Yes, I was grinning from ear to ear, till she added cheerfully, "Hang on to it, honey. Pleats will come back someday." Southerners are born storytellers. So when Garden and Gun asks its readers to spin a typical tale using just five words, here's what they got. Somebody done ate the biscuits. Fry it, then try it. Found this in the dishwasher. Barbecue sauce arguments ended friendships. After all, we called him Stump. Collard spun in the washer. I tried having my mother's phone disconnected, but the customer service rep told me that since the account was in my dad's name, he'd have to be the one to put in the request. The fact that he'd been dead for 40 years didn't sway her. Then a solution hit me. If I stop paying the bill, you can turn off the service, right? Well, yes, she said reluctantly, but that would ruin his credit. That's from Rocky Mount, North Carolina, no less. I make mistakes, and I'll be the second person to admit it. Since the coronavirus outbreak, my 47-year-old son has been washing his hands religiously. In fact, he said, I've been washing my hands so much, I found the answers to an old 8th-grade math quiz. Let's do some quotable quotes. I'd rather regret the risk that didn't work out than the chances I didn't take at all. From Simone Biles, the gymnast. I have confidence now that comes from a combination of years of experience and not caring anymore. Alton Brown, TV personality. Our job as parents is to put ourselves out of a job. Julie Lincloth Hames, an author. Life is too short to miss out on the beautiful things like a double cheeseburger. Channing Tatum. Listen to everyone, then I do what I want. Diane von Furstenberg, designer. There's a reason it took an American to invent the rocking chair. Even when we're sitting still, we like to feel as if we're in motion. Colin Jost, comedian. I could give an example of example how doing the right thing ended up making us more money. Yvonne Chouinard, Patagonia founder. I'm what you would call a piece of work in progress. Cindy Lauper, musician. A point to ponder. It really is the greatest privilege given by one human being to another, to care for them at their most vulnerable time, to restore them to health when their bodies have betrayed them. They may barely know you, but at that moment you're on the most important person in their lives. Dr. Sanjay Gupta, neurosurgeon and TV correspondent. When Mom broke her leg, a life well lived, to her great surprise, everyone else stepped up. It was the first run of the family ski weekend in Colorado. It was a perfect spring morning, and the skies were cloudless and blue, the temperature warm. I was tired of considering opting out of the run, but the kids were whining about attending ski school, and I figured I should push through, that if I skipped out, then they'd think they could too. We dropped the kids at ski school, then charted our course on the mountain's map, a little traverse to a bunny hill, to a lift that was take us to the good stuff, where I would chase my brother, his wife, and my husband at, who were already off and running figuratively. I pushed off and caught up with my sister-in-law. My legs felt heavy. I debated again, calling it a day. Then 3 minutes into the run, my left ski came off, then my right ski inverted and took my leg with it, twisting it like a Raggedy Ann doll's. I remember seeing my ski careening toward me at an obscene angle, and then I heard the crack. I lay splattered on the snow, screaming. My leg distorted at a right angle to my body. My sister-in-law heard my shrieks and doubled back. A kind volunteer EMT stopped and phoned ski patrol. I was strapped onto a toboggan and taken down the mountain to an ambulance. Shaking on the x-ray table, unable to control my limbs as shock set in, I kept apologizing to the technician. I'm sorry. I'm trying to hold still. I know I'm making your job harder. I was embarrassed for needing the help, for inconveniencing people whose job it was to heal me. A nurse smiled kindly and said, Oh, sweetie, once you see your x-ray, you'll understand. I woke up after surgery with my leg bandaged beyond recognition, with tubes coming out of various limbs, with my mouth sandpaper dry, and my mind flying in confused. The operation had required 2 bone grafts, donor bone from cadavers, to fill the chunk I'd obliterated. It was in a million pieces, the doctor said. They'd inserted a titanium rod, a dozen or so screws. I wouldn't walk for 3 months. Optimistically, I couldn't drive. I couldn't navigate the steps in our house. I couldn't even shower on my own. I would be sent home to California with a machine designed to train my leg to regain its manner of motion. I would sit in it for 6 hours a day, and when I wasn't sitting in the machine, I would be at a physical therapy or confined to a bed rest. I was high as could be on my IV drip, but sober enough to turn to Adam and ask, how are we going to manage? Who would get the kids to the bus at 7:15 a.m.? Since my husband was in his office by 6 a.m. each day. Who would deal with the dogs? Two young bunches of Labradors who relied on my companionship and long walks. Who would prepare dinner? Who would drive to tennis practice and softball games and sleepovers? We'll figure it out, Adam said. I nodded because what was the alternative? But nowhere in any of my Vicodin-infused cells did I believe him. Not even a tiny bit. Because my brain was pooling with glorious white noise from my pain pump, I posted about my accident on Facebook, an image of me with tubes up my nostrils and a snapshot of my leg wrapped and swollen, and something unexpected happened. A deluge not just of sympathy and frowny faces, but friends, both near and far, chiming in, imploring for ways they could help. I wrote each person back, thanking them for all, but not taking them up on their kind offers. The cavalry showed up anyway. By the time we returned home, a friend had already set up a dinner train. Meals for my family were taken care of for the first month of my recovery. Parents at our school bus stop offered to drop my kids off each afternoon. Parents sent care packages of books and food. Others restocked our fridge. After a particularly brutal doctor's appointment, in which I was told that my recovery was progressing well enough, but certainly not quickly, and that weight-bearing was still far out of reach, a friend simply sat with me while I came completely undone. Sometimes that's the best thing you could do, you know, is just to sit with somebody when they're having a problem. My children learned to be both autonomous and empathetic. They ran up the steps each day after school to check on me. My daughter set up her karaoke machine by the couch to keep me entertained while I embarked on my slow, cruel, and mandated PPE exercises. My son dutifully fetched my laptop, charger, or a fork or a bottle of water when asked, never whining, as he would have in the past. My kids no longer had the luxury of my setting out their school clothes and packing their lunches or ensuring that their homework was filled. So they learned to do it themselves, and in a surprise, perhaps only to me, everyone was all the better for it. And my husband, the man who previously had to be told what to do and when to do it, and sometimes why, too. This is what my husband did when I went down on the mountain. He pulled our family and me back up. He signed the permission slips and ordered the dog food, and when the dinner train ended, he cooked for everyone. In the early days, he carried me into the shower, where I would sit on a chair and let the hot water relieve my broken body. And then he carried me out. He did all this without complaint, because, as he said to me once simply, after all the years that you did so much, it was my turn to show up. On our 13th wedding anniversary, we didn't go to Mexico as we planned. Instead, on that day, when we had avowed ourselves for better or worse, my husband led me down the steps into his car and took me to physical therapy. This is a metaphor. Sometimes, many times, both in life and in marriage, you hope for the sunset overlooking the ocean off a deserted beach. But what you get is a drive to physical therapy. That's okay. Maybe that's actually how it should be. Eventually, I returned to the grocery shopping and the bus pickup. I made dinners again. I organized everyone and sent them out the door. But something profound had shifted in our household, in me. Now I am quicker to offer help if I sense that a friend is in need. I am quicker to ask for help if I am the one needing. When I went down on that mountain, I worried that my injury would upend everything. It turns out that it did. I won the 49th Pillsbury Bake Off. Melissa Pajolins, age 48, of Hudsonville, Michigan. Your recipe is called the Dublin Cheeseboard Stuffed Appetizer Bread. What is that? On our 25th anniversary, my husband and I went to Ireland. The first thing he ate was a cheese board with meats and cheese and fruits. I took the idea and stuffed it into Pillsbury French bread. You could use only 8 ingredients, so I put nuts on top for a crunch, apricot and arugula to sort of decorate the board, and a side serving of jam. That left me with 2 meats and 2 cheeses, though honestly, I'm not a huge cheese eater. A cheese board expert who doesn't like cheese? Nope. If I'm going to eat any cheese, it's goat cheese. I'm not a recipe follower either. You don't follow recipes? How did you end up at this contest? Like, just like some people are good with their hands, I know what flavors to throw in. Drives my kids crazy. Mom, how do I make this? And I just go, well, this is what goes in, but that's all I can tell you. Does the restaurant in Dublin know they inspired a flake-off winner? We haven't been able to get back yet, but are hoping to go next spring. They might not even know what the Pillsbury Bake Off is over there. Pillsbury Award Jolens, the $50,000 grand prize, live on Food Network. Her appetizer beat out recipes in the breakfast, dinner, and dessert categories. Wow, 50 grand. Your true stories in 100 words. A Doll's House, condensed version. I own a dollhouse shop and quite frequently find myself trying to fit a dollhouse into a customer's car. One day I was having trouble squeezing one into a back seat when the customer who brought it told me to step aside and hand it to her. Within seconds, she had fit that dollhouse into her car. Amazed, I asked her how she knew she could do it. She replied, "I'm an obstetrician." Julie Sylvester, Enrico, Virginia. Fueling the fire. My three-year-old granddaughter was trying to roast marshmallows for the first time. Her first two attempts ended in flames. Both times I took the scorched marshmallows and threw it into the fire. The third time I helped her a lot more, and together we achieved a perfectly toasted golden brown. Once it was cool, I handed her the marshmallow, which she promptly threw into the fire. No one had told her she was supposed to eat it. Under her wing, my stepdaughter, Pamela, a veterinarian, was visiting her aunt when they noticed a butterfly flying erratically around the room. Cupping it in her hands, Pamela realized a quarter of its wing was missing. While Auntie held the wing still with toothpicks, Pamela performed surgery with scissors and a contact cement. She fashioned a tiny prosthesis from a napkin and gently attached it to the wing. A minute later, the creature fluttered out a nearby window. As the two women were congratulating each other, the butterfly re-entered the room, flew around, and landed directly over Pamela's heart. Bob McCormick, Kings Beach, California. By the way, the marshmallow was by Lou Rose, Parachute, Colorado. The new family unit. My parents divorced when I was 5, and I don't remember them saying more than hi or bye to each other for the rest of my childhood. I went to my dad's house every other weekend, and they didn't really speak to each other during the transfer. Years later, when my dad was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, my husband and I invited him to move in with us and our 4 children. "Mom, how are we going to do this?" I asked. "Papa is going to be here all the time, and we still want you to come and visit. We want it to be weird." "Not a problem," Mom replied confidently. "We're just going to get over our past and all be friends." I was so relieved. At our first family dinner together, I sat next to my sister, the daughter of my mom and my stepdad, and I looked around. Mom, Papa, my stepdad, Doug, all at the same table. "Weirdest thing ever," I whispered to my sister. "Yes, but nobody else seemed to think so," she replied. "It's amazing." For the next 10 years, Papa lived with us, and whenever Mom and Doug came over, the three of them would chat like old friends. And in a way, they were. My whole childhood, I had wished that my three parents could all get along. And here they were. It wasn't exactly what I'd had in mind, but God knows what He is doing. And there's no name to that one. And here's one that's always fun. The food on your plate. I'm a tomato, or tomato, depending on where you're from. An American love story. You know me as pure warm weather joy. You know that when you eat me with wool like a fruit, that's what I am. I burst all over your shirt if you don't slurp carefully. What you might not know is that while I feel like an ancient human pleasure, I spread through the world only in the past few centuries, embedding myself in cuisines from Armenia to Nigeria. And the origin story that led me to you is especially twisting. Let's start in what is now Italy in the 17th century. I was transported there from Mexico by the Spaniards, having traveled to the Middle East and North Africa before sailing up the peninsula. Italy was just a puzzle of disparate states then. By the time the nation was formed in the 1860s, I had blossomed into a symbol of unification, the red and the Italian flag that would sit alongside basil green and mozzarella white, and any number of patriotic dishes, from caprese salad to pizza margherita. Millions of Italians then streamed across the Atlantic, fleeing poverty in Naples and Sicily, and I went with them. In the home country, every little corner of Italy had a signature cooking style. But in America, These differences get all mixed up. Few of the dishes you call Italian, spaghetti with meatballs, chicken parma, Sunday gravy, were traditions in Italy. They arose instead from creative minds and hands of these immigrants making do with what they had in their new home. And what brought it together into a single splatter was yours truly, mostly in the form of red sauce. This culinary bonding wouldn't have been possible without my canned form. I'm far too seasonal and perishable to supply so many stockpots of sauce year-round without preservation. Once the 1930s rolled in, California was canning more of me than were being imported from Italy. In 1914, a northern Italian teenager named Biorati arrived and quickly established himself as a successful restaurant in Cleveland. And he discovered that canning his tomato puree and selling it bundled with dried spaghetti and a canister of cheese was the real meal ticket. Chef Boyardee became one of America's first celebrity chefs. And his original spelling was B-O-I-A-R-D-I. But, of course, the thing on the Americanized was B-O-Y-A-R-D-E-E. Boyardee. I'm good for more than just your taste buds. Your skin benefits from my abundant lycopene. The carotenoid that gives me my red color. People whose diets are high in lycopene are actually thought to be a smidge more protected from the sun's UV rays. Your eyes feast on my lutein, a retina-supporting antioxidant. You may have heard that tomatoes and my nightshade brethren are bad for rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune disorders, but no studies have established such a connection. In fact, doctors recommend a diet high in the nutrients that we shady fruits offer. How can you enjoy me at my best? Some basics. Tomatoes that are fresh, fleshier, such as those oblong plump tomatoes you'll find at the supermarket, are better for making sauce, while tomatoes that are seedier, such as the round, medium-sized Jersey and beefsteak varieties, are better for eating raw. That assumes I'm in season and truly ripe. And let me put it to you straight. It's not worth bothering with most tomatoes off-season. See, just after I've hit my moment of flavorful perfection, the downward spiral is precipitous. I go from ready to rotten practically overnight. This, of course, is terrible for large-scale agriculture and shipping. So big farmers typically breed me for robustness, not flavor, and pick me early so I can withstand long journeys by truck, train, and boat. They expose me to ethylene gas to turn my green-pink color red, but that does little for how I taste. That said, if it's wintertime and you've hated up and you're hard up for a love apple, as I'm called in some languages, cherry and grape tomatoes tend to be better options. They're less prone to breaking down or being damaged under their own weight during shipping. They also have a higher ratio of seed jelly to flesh, which means more flavor, even when I'm underripe. There are tricks for improving a mediocre tomato. Have me and roast me in a low-temp oven, 300 degrees or so, to remove moisture and concentrate any flavor that is there. This can work for salsa or tomato sauce. You can also try dicing me and using a fine macerator to extract my excess water, concentrating tomato-y flavor left behind to improve your gawk. A summer me picked locally and close to my prime avoids all that rigmarole. Heirloom tomatoes will remind you that I am sometimes purple, yellow, orange, reddish yellow, or even green when fully ripe, and can be egg-shaped, heart-shaped, or elongated with ridges that make me look as pleated as a dress. Once at home, store me stem side down. Since moisture loss, which hastens rot, happens via my stem. Conventional wisdom is to never refrigerate a tomato, but I would offer a different edict. Do not refrigerate an underripe tomato. A fully ripe one is far better off in the fridge, where it will hold decay at bay longer than it would in your countertop. Give me a few minutes to warm up back up before eating. You won't regret it, even if your shirt suffers a little seedy summertime juice. Tuscan salad. Cut or tear a half-pound rustic crust bread into 1.5-inch pieces. Arrange in a single layer on a rimmed baking sheet and toast in a 325-degree oven, turning occasionally until dried and crispy throughout. In a large salad bowl, toss bread with 1.5 pounds of diced tomatoes and their juices. Use any kind except fleshy sauce tomatoes, such as plum. 2 tablespoons red or white wine vinegar, 1/2 cup extra virgin olive oil, a handful of torn basil leaves, and 1/2 of a medium red onion, thinly sliced. If desired, add peeled and diced cucumbers, seasoned with salt and pepper. There's a picture of it. It's very colorful and very sweet looking. Thou shalt not steal. A 400-year-old Bible was among hundreds of items stolen in one of the largest library heists ever recorded. The Bible was recovered last year and returned to the Carnegie Library in Pittsburgh, but it isn't back in the archives yet. After all, the rare books room is still an active crime scene. I'm going to switch over to an article from Consumer Reports. We're going to run out of Reader's Digest here if I don't start getting back to our old regime of half of the Reader's Digest, half of the Consumer Reports. Anyway, this article is very interesting. It's called More Choice, More Power. Alternatives to traditional medical care, including on-demand house calls, virtual doctor visits, and workplace health clinics, are on the rise. Which one is best for you? Elizabeth Machel grew frustrated that she couldn't get same-day appointment with her daughter's pediatrician when smack in the middle of flu season, the 3-year-old woke up with a high fever and had a cough. So the 39-year-old from Hayward, California, turned to an app-based service called Heal, which connected her with a physician within 2 hours. Better yet, the doctor came to her house. I had to have to get my daughter dressed or deal with taking my other kids to the doctor's office, Machel said. Ilya Ginsberg, 34, had a different experience. After moving to San Francisco for a new job, Ginsberg, who has high blood pressure, struggled to find a primary care doctor despite having a list of physicians from his insurer. Some no longer accepted his plan. Others weren't taking new patients. A few had simply closed up shop. His solution, One Medical, a network of primary care clinics that guarantee same or next day appointments and offer virtual visits. I found a doctor who I can trust who knows me, he says. For Gary Blankenship, 70-year-old retired truck driver in Lynchburg, Virginia, one big problem was the long waits to the doctor's office made worse by stiff chairs that were hard on his bad back. So Blankenship was thrilled when his doctor went solo, opening a new type of practice known as direct primary care, which offers a variety of perks, including no long waits and 24/7 availability. It's almost like having a private doctor, like wealthy people and movie stars have, Blankenship says. As those examples illustrate, finding a primary care provider, someone who helps oversee all your health care needs and doesn't just treat common issues such as flu and sprains, can be hard. At the same time, out-of-pocket costs for doctor visits are rising, leaving consumers more hesitant to make those appointments. Partly as a result, Americans are turning to alternative models of primary care. Options include full-service walk-in health clinics in big-box stores, such as Walmart's or drugstores, like CVS, apps that offer real-time video chats with a healthcare provider, and high-end concierge practices at large university medical centers. The big question, can these options provide convenient, affordable ways for you to get the quality of care you need? Why primary care is key. It used to be that people typically relied on a go-to doctor who took care of all their general medical needs, knew their health histories as well, recommended specialists, and checked on them if they were hospitalized. That kind of care remains essential, says Margot Savoy, MD, a family physician in Philadelphia, and a member of the American Academy of Family Physicians Board of Directors. These providers can not only give physical exams and vaccines administered or order screening tests and deal with problems such as infections and minor injuries, but also help manage chronic conditions like diabetes and high blood pressure. Importantly, they also coordinate the care you receive from other health care providers, such as, say, a cardiologist if you have heart problems. A primary care doctor should be a quarterback for your health team, Savoy says. That care usually comes from a doctor trained in internal medicine, family practice, pediatrics, or geriatrics. These physicians can be MDs or doctors of osteopathy, doctors of osteopathic medicine, whose medical education includes special training in muscle and skeletal issues. Some people regularly see a specialist, such as an OBGYN, but they typically can't offer the same breadth of care as a primary care provider. Fewer MDs, broader needs. And yet getting time with a primary care provider becoming harder for several reasons. A smaller percentage of medical school graduates are choosing primary care or opting for more lucrative specialties. Those who remain carry ever large patient loads. Each typical has 1,200 to 1,900 patients and sees an average of 20 each day. That, combined with growing administrative tasks and ever-changing regulatory requirements, is causing many primary care doctors to report burnout. In one study, doctors reported devoting almost half their day to administrative chores and only one quarter to seeing patients. Thanks to the growing number of older people in the U.S. who are especially likely to require regular or comprehensive care, the need for primary care providers is growing. The Association of American Medical Colleges predicts a shortage of up to 5,500 primary care physicians nationwide by 2032. Worrying there has already been a steep decline in the number of people getting regular primary care. Among people with private health insurance, appointments with primary care providers dropped 24% between 2008 and 2016, while appointments with specialists remained the same. According to a recent study at the Journal Annals of Internal Medicine, two big reasons Americans don't get the care they need, cost and convenience. But some of that decline may also be generational. Gen Zers, Millennials, and Gen Xers are less likely to have a primary care doctor than older generations, according to a 2019 Consumer Reports nationally represented survey of 3,030 adults. The search for alternatives. Many experts welcome the new avenues for primary care. Innovation in primary care is a good thing, says Ishana Gagli, MD, at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, lead author of the recent Annals of Internal Medicine study on the decline in appointments with primary care doctors. We need to make primary care more convenient and accessible because it's clear that people who get regular primary care have better health, she adds. Consumers are also embracing these newer options, says Kavel Savai, MD, a senior managing director for consulting firm Accenture's. Global healthcare business. For instance, almost half the respondents in a 2019 Accenture survey on consumer digital health trends say they've used a walk-in or retail clinic, and 29% have tried some form of virtual care, and 18% have used on-demand healthcare services such as the one Elizabeth Bassell used. But sorting through old and new to find one that's right for you may feel overwhelming. Take cost. Because many of the new services accept health insurance, similar to the way a traditional medical practice does, if you have coverage, your out-of-pocket expenses could be about the same. Some don't accept insurance and charge flat fees instead. That cuts the provider's administrative costs and could be more affordable for some people with high deductibles or no insurance. But in some cases, the alternatives come at a premium. Ilya Ginsberg, for example, spends $199 per year for his one medical membership, on top of paying for his regular health insurance. Gary Blankenship pays $80 monthly to feed to his doctor, along with the cost of his Medicare premiums. Both consider the added convenience valuable enough to justify the extra cost. If I have a problem, my doctor will either see me right away or call in a prescription if I need one, Blankenship says. It's well worth it. Ultimately, to help you find the option or combination that's best for you, we took a close look at how primary care practices are changing and the growing number of alternatives, reviewed the research, and we spoke with experts and patients. Eight places to get your primary care. Traditional primary care. About a third of the 700,000 practicing doctors in the U.S. are primary care providers. They often work in group practices and are affiliated with larger healthcare systems. The practices tend to be open during normal office hours, but within a doctor on call at other times. Some are trying to reinvent themselves by offering extended hours, weekend appointments, online booking, email access to a doctor, and follow-up care via computer or smartphone, says Kaveh Safai, MD, a senior managing director for consulting with Accenture's global healthcare business. Practices are also hiring non-doctors providers such as physician's assistants, PAs, and nurse practitioners, NPA, to take on some of the workload. Physician's assistants work under a supervising physician and can often do many of the same things as MDs and DOs, such as physical exams, ordering x-rays, and prescribing medication. Nurse practitioners must be registered nurses before they go on to get advanced training. In some cases, they can practice on their own and, like PAs, prescribe drugs and diagnose and treat common health problems. Still, even if doctors have the technology and desire to provide more convenient services, administrative burdens remain, Safari says. Doctors only have so much time in a day, he says. While private insurers, Medicare and Medicaid, now come with the cost of e-visits, doctors aren't always reimbursed at the same rate for those visits, giving doctors less incentive to provide them. Just 17% of primary care doctors say they practice some form of telemedicine, a 2018 survey by the nonprofit Physicians Foundation found. How you pay? Most accept your plan. You may owe deductibles, what you pay out of pocket before insurance kicks in. Co-pays, a flat fee with each appointment, typically about $20 to $25. And co-insurance is a percentage, typically 18% for people insured through work, of the cost of the medical services you get. Consider four, routine and preventive care problems that need attention but aren't emergencies, managing chronic health problems and coordinating with your other providers. Watch out for long waits for appointments, limited time with your doctor. Urgent care clinics. These standalone facilities, often part of a privately owned chain or run by hospitals, are staffed by doctors, PAs, and NPs, and handle problems from colds and the flu to sprains and asthma. The nearly 10,000 urgent care clinics in the U.S., up from 6,100 in 2013, usually offer on-site lab tests and diagnostic imaging, such as x-rays, and some are open 7 days a week. How you pay? Many take insurance, so you may have deductibles, co-pays, and co-insurance. The average out-of-pocket cost of an urgent care visit for someone with insurance ranges from $165 to $190, according to the Urgent Care Association. Consumer tips. Consider four, problems that need to be treated right away but aren't severe enough to require the emergency room. That's Asu Krikorian, a 65-year-old retiree in Tampa, Florida, uses these services. Although I go to my primary care for yearly physicals, I prefer a local urgent care center when I am ill, Krikorian says. I can make an appointment at urgent care and get in there the same day. Recently, unsure of the cause of a cough, a headache, and fatigue, Krikorian booked an appointment on a nearby clinic's website. Within 2 hours, she had seen a doctor and received an upper respiratory infection diagnosis. They even looked up where it was least expensive to fill my prescription and printed out a coupon for me, she says. Watch out for possible lack of coordination with primary care doctor and unnecessary prescriptions, particularly antibiotics. A September 2018 study in the Journal of Internal Medicine found that inappropriate prescribing of those drugs for viral respiratory infections at 46% of visits were higher in urgent care clinics than at doctor's offices or walk-in clinics. Retail walk-in clinics. The roughly 2,700 health clinics located in chain pharmacies, supermarkets, and retail stores, up from 1,200 in 2010, according to the Convenient Care Association, offer no appointment needed treatments, staffed mainly by PAs and NPs. They're typically open every day and have become a common source of care for nearly a quarter of Americans with no primary care doctor, CR survey found. Some of these clinics, such as the Minute Clinics, are more than 1,000 target locations in CVS drugstores, have been around since the early 2000s. What's new is that CVS and several other retailers are expanding the services they offer. CVS recently launched more than 50 of a planned 1,500 health hubs, where consumers can get nutrition counseling, attend wellness classes, and receive help managing chronic conditions, such as type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure, as well as vaccines and treatments for problems like colds and flu. Anthony G. Green, 51, considers himself a regular at the CVS Health Hub in Marietta, Georgia, consulting with the store's care concierge on everything from diabetes, chest, minor urgent care, urgent services such as stitches and wellness programs like weight management and nutrition counseling. Doctors, not just patients, appreciate the extra time they could spend with patients in this kind of practice, Andrew J. Anderson, OO, the doctor in charge of Gary Blankenship, sees in Lynchburg, Virginia, says in a former practice he had 2,400 patients, seeing 20 a day and spending less than 10 minutes with each. Now he has 400, see 7 or 8 a day, and can spend more than 30 minutes with each one. Well, my apology, I kind of messed that up. I went to the wrong page here. Several of the retailers are also offering a more robust roster of services. Walmart runs 2 standalone Walmart health clinics in Georgia, with more expected later this year. The company says you can choose to see the same physician at each visit so you can develop a relationship with the provider. Walgreens is ramping up its options, too. In partnership with the Village MD of Chain of Primary Care Practices, the company recently opened a clinic near Houston with plans to open more in the future. How you pay. These accept insurance, so you may still have deductibles, copays, and co-insurance. For people without insurance, some offer a menu of services for a flat fee. At Walmart Health Centers, you can get checkups for $30, office visits for $40, cholesterol tests for $10, and stitches for about $115, as well as dental exams for $50. Consider for routine or simple but non-urgent medical needs, such as vaccines, treatments for colds, strep throat, cuts and rashes, and simple screenings, such as blood pressure and cholesterol tests. Limited services, in some cases, lack of coordination with your regular providers. Then there's direct primary care, which we already touched on a little bit with the earlier thing where I screwed up and got the RAND things. Let's look at concierge care. These practices are similar to direct primary care, but are aimed at those willing to spend more for luxury care. That includes same-day appointments, quick answers to calls or texts, and sometimes access to top doctors at prestigious medical centers, or perks such as body composition analysis and coaching by personal trainers. High-end concierge practices have been around for a few decades, but only about 20,000 physicians practice in them, according to Concierge Medicine Today, a trade publication. Several major medical centers, including Cleveland Clinic, Florida and Weston, Duke Health in Durham, North Carolina, and Stanford Healthcare in California, have added concierge services. Cleveland Clinic's Florida programs even offer use of the clinic's private fleet of land and air ambulances in an emergency for an additional fee. How you pay. The annual fee, which is not covered by insurance, averages about $2,000, can be 10 times that amount in practices with very few patients, says Thomas Legrelis, MD, president of the American College of Private Physicians, which represents concierge physicians. Many will also bill your insurer for the care they provide, and you still need insurance to cover hospitalizations, emergency care, and services that the concierge practice doesn't provide. Best for people willing to pay for very personalized care, extensive time with their doctor, and a host of wellness amenities. Watch out for possibly offering screening tests that most generally healthy people don't need. For example, the Food and Drug Administration cautions against full-body screening CT scans, which some concierge practices offer, because they can expose people to significant radiation and often cause false positives. High-tech hybrids. These are companies that have both virtual and personal care, with a traditional office visit, a video chat, or an app that performs on an initial diagnosis, and a phone or in-person follow-up as needed. These hybrids are primary in major metropolitan areas and often housed in modern spaces that look more like a spa than a doctor's office. Some have venture capital backing and celebrity investors. For example, investors in Forward, founded in 2016 and based in San Francisco, include former Google CEO Eric Schmidt, actor Ashton Kutcher, and NBA star Kevin Durant. Like direct primary care, Forward accepts no insurance. Instead, it charges $149 per month for unlimited doctor visits and 24/7 remote access to its physicians. It emphasizes preventive care, including genetic testing and immediate blood test results. Forward is still small, with 5 locations around Los Angeles and San Francisco, 2 in New York City, and 1 in Washington, D.C. Some hybrids, such as Garmin Health, based in California, accept many insurance plans, in which cases you pay for each visit as you would a traditional provider, without a pocket cost for copays, coinsurance, and deductibles. If your insurance isn't accepted or you don't have insurance, Garmin has a flat fee service, and a new patient physical, for example, costs $199. How to make sure your doctor treats you well. While most people say they have a good relationship with their doctors, that's not always the case. According to a nationally representative consumer report say of about 3,300 adults, 5% cite a lack of professionalism and respect, and more, 17%, say doctors don't always put the patient's interests first, and that includes putting them ahead of profits. Plus, 11% of people feel their doctors don't listen and don't genuinely consider what they say before offering a treatment plan. That's backed up by other research. In a 2018 analysis, barely one-third of physicians asked patients why they were visiting, and 67% of those doctors interrupted patients, some after 11 seconds or less. Members of certain groups in the CR survey have additional concerns, for instance. More than 10% of those who are black, overweight, or LGBTQ feel they've received inadequate care because of those characteristics. As one overweight CR respondent wrote, "I'm treated like less than human and not worth the time to get myself healthy." One possible reason, implicit bias, in which a doctor makes judgments and decisions based on certain traits, says Kevin Fasella, MD, co-director of the Center for Communications Disparity Research at the University of Rochester Medical Center, New York, "because this bias is unconscious, it's hard to fix. But expert advice the following if you're unhappy with something your provider says, does, or fails to do. Express concern clearly or calmly. Ask for clarification. Persist. If your doctor brushes off a concern, saying pain is simply part of aging, for example, keep pushing. If you say gently but forcefully, this is affecting my quality of life and I want to explore the options, that should trigger the doctor to slow down and know when to move on. If those steps don't help, it may be time for a new physician. And while the clarification may seem odd, for instance, for a doctor to suggest an HIV test to a gay patient who comes and complains of a respiratory infection, but swollen glands, sore throat, and fever can indicate HIV infection," Fasella says. "Asking why a provider recommends a test or treatment can clear things up. And if you express your concerns clearly and calmly, a physician viewing them in a certain way that is concerning them, then they should call it out. You're giving the doctor the benefit of the doubt that they're not trying to be offensive, but at the same time letting them know they need to be more sensitive to your needs." And with that, we're just about to run out of time here. Today's episode of the Reader's Digest and a little bit of Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next week. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. By the way, that's NC Reading Service, not North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening. And I apologize if it's kind of weird because we did have a little electrical problem here that kind of screwed things up.